Track 16. This is the Great Lives feature. A brave countrywoman, fighter, farmer, and one-time fascist. This month, our resident historian tells the sad story of the life of Lucilla Reeve.
"Well, Armstrong," said the officer, "if you insist on drinking a bottle of beer when you think I can't see you, I suggest you take off your throat microphone first." The occasion was a school CCF field day, circa 1960, an annual jaunt to play soldiers. I had reached the dizzy heights of Lance Corporal in the signal section and therefore was equipped with a radio. Instead of a conventional microphone, I had one slung about my throat, which I had forgotten to switch off when a momentary pause in hostilities offered me the opportunity to get the smuggled bottle of beer out of my pack. As a result, the poor man had nearly been deafened by the broadcast appreciative gurgles as I put away a bottle of light ale. No punishment ensued, probably because the alter ego of the officer was as master in charge of second 11's cricket, and I was due to open the batting in the match the next day scheduled for detention. That field day was the occasion of my only visit to the Stanford Battle Area, now the Stanford Training Area. This extraordinary area, comprising eventually about 30,000 acres a few miles north of Thetford, was commandeered in 1942 by the Army for the purpose of training troops for battle. It has been used for the same purpose ever since, and this part of Breckland has played the part of a fictitious Northern Europe and a fictitious Afghanistan. Recently, it has been used for the training of Ukrainian soldiers. The area commandeered included six villages with a total population of something like 1,000 who were required to leave their homes at a month's notice, their communities broken up, their houses left to be destroyed by either simulated military action or just by the ravages of time. The only original buildings still recognizable are the churches of the four villages, their external structures maintained by the Ministry of Defense. They are joined in a religious enclave by a mosque, built to add realism when an Afghan village was constructed in the area for training during the Afghanistan War. Those expelled from the area were rehoused elsewhere, and many believed their removal was only temporary. They would be able to return after the war. What was agreed at the time has been a matter of dispute ever since, but no return has ever been permitted. What is clear is that many of the villagers felt they had been promised they would be able to return when the war was over. The disruption for all of them must have been huge, to be uprooted from what may have been their family home for generations with all its associated memories. Even the graves of their ancestors must have been exceptionally sad. None of them will ever have felt this sadness more than the remarkable woman who is the subject of this article. Lucilla Reeves was an extraordinary woman, born illegitimately in 1889 to a parlourmaid in landowner Lord Walsingham's employment. It was believed by many that the unnamed father was a member of the aristocracy, rumoured in some quarters to have been Lord Walsingham himself. Educated in part at the village school, sources suggest that most of her education was in London and paid for by an anonymous benefactor, which must have set the local speculative tongues wagging even faster. Her education brought out some of her inborn literary talents. She became a poet, a published author, and a regular contributor to the local press. To these talents she added both the skill of a water diviner and an astonishing degree of determination. Both were to be evident in her later life. She was also commercially minded, progressing from a secretarial role to become the land agent for Lord Walsingham's Merton estate. This role carried heavy responsibilities, which she discharged with characteristic vigour. She was responsible, inter alia, for the maintenance of both the farms and the tied cottages on the estate. A particularly trying task was finding tenants for the farms during the agricultural depression of the 1930s. There were very few potential candidates. The pressure to ensure that all the farms were tenanted was extreme. At one stage, 8 were vacant, and the bank was insistent that at least 7 of them should be let in short order. She was particularly pleased with her success at letting one of them to a group of Yorkshire businessmen who were looking for somewhere suitable to hatch and grow ducks. Having used her contacts and her commercial skills to get them to examine the site, she found that their initial enthusiasm was diluted by concerns about the apparent lack of water available. As she expressed herself when writing about the incident, "They didn't say much, but they looked volumes of doubt," as they surveyed the scene. She had a solution, calling on her other skill as a dowser. The potential tenants looked askance when she cut a cleft stick of thorn and walked across the field, identifying three sources of water. Subsequent excavation proved her to be correct. She said that she overcame their initial doubts as to her ability when she got them to hide a half crown in some deep grass, and she was able to locate it using just her divining rod. Once the water finds were confirmed, the deal was done. What made this woman remarkable? She was unconventional, even eccentric. Standing just a few inches over 5 feet tall, she was a woman of strong views, with the confidence to express them. While a devout Christian, she also dabbled with the supernatural, seeing ghosts. She dressed in a dark skirt and jacket, which covered a blouse tightly buttoned to the neck and a pullover. She was adept with machinery, just as happy with agricultural as with office equipment. Above all, she was a countrywoman with an exceptional affection for both the land and the animals around her. She had a nose for a fight and a belief in community, successfully leading a campaign to have proper recognition of those killed in the First War by the erection of a war memorial rather than just a plaque inside the village church. She drove around her domain in a bright red Singer two-seater and later on a motorcycle. Despite her being brought up locally by a mother whose family had lived there for generations, she was not universally liked. Not only was she responsible for collecting rents, she was also seen as different, both because of her education and her rumored parentage. And she certainly didn't help herself by her political affiliations. She became a dedicated follower of Oswald Mosley after hearing him speak in Swaffham in 1935, and was a member of the British Union of Fascists. Indeed, according to the website of the Friends of Oswald Mosley, she was adopted in 1937 as the BUF candidate for South West Norfolk, a claim I have not been able to verify from other sources. Whatever her political views, and she always denied any sympathy with the Nazis, she was to demonstrate great resilience in the face of the misfortunes which were to dog her for the rest of her life. Her affiliation with Mosley landed her in trouble during the war when she was investigated because of her fascist history. In a radio program about 20 years ago, the then Lord Walsingham said that his father had received a phone call from Whitehall to say that she was likely to be interned. He persuaded Whitehall not to do so, saying that if any Nazi landed in Norfolk, he would personally shoot Lucia. Despite his assurances, Lucia was questioned in depth before being allowed to remain at large. But her troubles began before the war. In 1938, she decided to take the tenancy of another property, Bagmore Farm, herself. Local opinion was that this was a brave decision. The farm had not been profitable, and the accommodation was very run down. But she had a different plan. She would turn it into a guest house. The amount of work needed was immense and expensive, but it seemed the best way to raise sufficient income to put the farm in order. There was no indoor sanitation, so the search was on for a bathroom and for gas lighting downstairs. Upstairs, candles would suffice. Finally, the work was done and Lucia employed a housekeeper to manage the business. When they were ready for guests, she discovered another snag. Few guests appeared. But by 1939, things were looking up a bit. She had dispensed with the housekeeper, taking the role herself, and she was already beginning to see some improvements in the farming. This gave her renewed optimism, but of brief duration. The workload must have been crippling, as she was also still acting as agent for the Merton estate. The regulatory changes as war broke out made great demands on her, both professionally and in terms of her own farming enterprise. She wrote about these in her book, Farming on a Battleground. The impact of the need for military training meant she had to witness the destruction of many of her achievements on the farm. Fencing torn down, tanks charging through her unharvested crops. Even for this remarkably strong-willed woman, it all became too much. Frustrated by regulation which seemed to ignore the value of food production, administered with total insensitivity, she was, on occasion, reduced to tears. Worse was to follow. In June 1941, she was informed of the decision that the military should take over 18,000 acres as a training area, including 8,000 of the acres for which she was responsible. It meant, she wrote, that she was to lose her farm, her home, and her office. What followed was chaos. As rumour succeeded rumour about whether the takeover would actually happen, about whether there would be compensation, insult was added to injury by the handling of the public meetings to explain the background, and Lucia's anger with the authorities leaps off the pages of her book. There was to be no reprieve, no compensation. And Lucia not only had to find a new home, but also had to sell her much-loved livestock quickly. She was offered a similar role on a smaller estate elsewhere in the county, but her heart was in Breckland, and although the move would have given her a home, staff to assist her, and security, she turned it down. Instead, she searched for a means of staying nearby. Her solution was typical of the woman. She acquired some old poultry sheds, and a friend re-erected them for her on a piece of wasteland nearby. These were to be her new home. She resigned as land agent, salvaged some furniture from her old home, and donated her other possessions to charity. When she moved, it must have been totally disheartening. In her own words, "I said goodbye, but had no tears left to shed." Her new home offered no comfort. Baking in summer, freezing in winter, she came to hate it. But she stuck it out, alone and largely friendless. She seemed indomitable. But it was an illusion. The cumulative effects of successive crises, disappointments, and battles with the authorities had taken their toll, and on Remembrance Day in 1950, she hanged herself. Her suicide meant that this lifelong Christian was denied burial within the churchyard, but her grave at its perimeter in time became absorbed within its boundaries. Thus ended the life of a really remarkable, courageous, and eccentric lady. A truly sad postscript to the Stanford story.